part of the reason why you said that you might have to change your menu? Is that also because, like, when you serve 60 people, like, having you just have to reprep all of everything, and that is probably challenging? Like, if you had to do that every night, would you have enough time in the day to do all the prep that needed to be done?
That's not what I was thinking, but that certainly is an element of it. I was thinking strictly on the two kind of pinch points, the two bottlenecks seem to be how many of our proteins come off of pans, and and basically how much room and hands we have to make the plates.
I see.
So it's extremely difficult, even though there's lots of hands in that kitchen, but like when we get a six top or an eight top, like you can just feel things really kind of not grind to a halt, but really slow down. Yeah,
but it's kind of got to be like an all hands on deck for that table or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I apologize in advance then, Alan.
You're bringing an eight top? Oh no.
Nine top next Thursday.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Like Thursday of next week? Or
Thursday, November. Oh, maybe it's the week after next. I think it's Thursday, November. Yeah. I think it's Thursday, November 4th. I'm pretty sure it was a Thursday.
And is that, that's obviously in lieu of your Tuesday reservation then?
No, I'm still coming in on Tuesday.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
I'm coming in on my own on Tuesday, but I wanted to do that sooner rather than later. And then also, like, yeah, but I thought because I had actually booked it for this week, you know, I thought it was going to be quite a bit before I was in with my family.
Right.
But now it just turns out that I'm going there twice in 1 week.
Okay, cool.
How things worked out, but whatever.
Awesome.
So yeah, I will have eaten there twice, I guess, before we actually record our next
episode. That's good, like a real food reviewer.
Yeah, exactly. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Shale.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. And we're going to talk about not really food this time.
That's right. Shale, I have to just hijack this for a second.
Okay, yeah.
Cora and I made a food joke this week. We wrote a food joke together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Can I tell it to you?
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm dying to hear it. This is going to so the beginning of the episode from now on is going to have to be kids food joke corner, and then we'll move on to feedback after that.
Episode. I was reminded, and it's too good to not share.
Okay, let's hear.
Shale.
Yes, Alan.
What kind of spice has an uncle?
I don't know.
A niece. Isn't that good?
Yeah, it's pretty good. That is pretty good. Yeah,
it's a classic
children misunderstanding a word that they haven't heard before joke. Yeah.
We like my kids, like if I leave the pantry open, they'll just start pulling out spices and opening them and smelling them.
Really?
Oh, cool. And so we were smelling one, and I said, "Oh yeah, that's a good one. That's anise." And then Cora said, "I'm anise."
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Totally.
Oh yeah, no, I understand.
And then
you
were like,
yeah.
Oh my god, there's a joke in it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then for the next 2 hours, that's all I thought. No, I was kidding. It came to us pretty quickly, but
sweet.
So there you go.
That's a good one, Alan. Just put that set that one aside for the book, for the joke, for the food joke book.
Well, I was gonna write it into Gene Perry and see if I can get
this
it.
This is also a great idea. Yeah. Do they pay by quality? Or?
It's got to be pro bono, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I don't know. When you were a kid, did you have joke books?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I had a couple of joke books, too. I don't think that exists anymore. Could be wrong, but...
Like, because of the internet?
No, because kids don't have a sense of humor these days.
Oh, harsh.
Get off my lawn.
You're such... Yeah, exactly.
Do we have any follow-up this week, Alan? Or were you going to say something else?
No, I don't have any follow-up from the...
Okay.
Certainly no Halloween candy-related follow-up.
Right. Oh, well, actually, I do have a little bit of follow-up about Halloween candy, and it's not really about the candy itself. It's about the episode. Mm-hmm. So for... I don't know. I guess this is like a public service announcement. It seems like potentially... There was a little bit of a weird issue when the spooky seasoning episode went up, and there was like I don't know, two copies of it or something. And then one of the copies got deleted from the feed after a day or something. Cause I don't know. I don't know what happened. Anyway, it seems like potentially some people's podcast player may have missed downloading the Spooky Seasoning episode, which if you haven't heard it, is our episode, wherein we, rank Halloween candy.
It's our love letter to Halloween candy show.
It's our love letter to Halloween candy. So yeah, if you haven't heard that episode, it's possible that your podcast player missed it. And if that is the case, you could just go into your podcast player and bring up our podcast, and it should be listed in there. It just may have gotten missed in the auto downloads or something like that. I'm not quite sure what happened. So if that's you, it's a classic, I gotta tell you. And then, okay, so, I have another piece of feedback here, or follow up, but I don't remember which episode it was in, and I don't know, potentially, Alan, maybe you do. I think you're a better food court historian than I am. But definitely at some point in one episode, I derided the joy of cooking. For, you know, like being, I guess, like dated and full of bad information or something.
For the quality of the recipes, I think, right?
Yeah. Like joy of cooking. Yeah. So maybe it was in the Do Recipes Work episode or something like that?
I think
that.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, this week my sister found like a quote from Julia Child wherein she, you know, basically says that the joy of cooking is an indispensable resource. So now it feels like by saying the joy of cooking sucks, I'm going against Julia Child.
Right.
And I mean, clearly I would never go against Julia Child. So, I mean, if it's good enough for Julia, it's good enough for me.
I think your comments about the, like, we were doing a deep dive on what is essential information to include in recipes. And yeah, even though you kind of wholesale threw out Best of Bridge and Joy of Cooking and dismissed it as drivel, those books got a lot of people cooking, and I'm sure like made a lot of tasty food happen for families. You're nitpicking on recipe quality notwithstanding. So I don't think you have to, walk it back.
Wait, didn't you? it started out like you. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. You're right. Man, Alan, where do you get an attitude like that? Can you buy one of those? Like, you're so optimistic, and I don't know. I love your commentary.
Take it, yours, like your opinion on it. You're coming from a very different place than the people who use those books daily.
Most certainly.
So yeah. I think that when you look at the
not in the case of Julia, though, you know, like this, I guess, is what, you know, like, you know, I definitely hold Julia Child in high esteem, even though, like, you know, I suppose if you look at her repertoire as well, from our eyes, a lot of it is like old school and dated. But, you know, like in the same vein as what you were just saying, like, you know, Julia Child and her passion about cooking, you know, changed tons of people's, you know, lives in terms of how they cook for themselves or their families, or how they felt about being able to cook what they probably considered to be like fancy food or whatever. And And if Julia is willing to recommend the Joy of Cooking as like an indispensable resource, then great. If you have one on your shelf, maybe you should crack it open sometime.
I will say, we don't have to talk about Julia Child the whole time, but like I'm really only familiar with her. Oh, what's the actual name? Like the Art of French Cooking?
Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Right. So I'm really only familiar with Mastering the Art of French Cooking. I don't even know what other books she wrote. I assume there's 100.
Several, I'm sure. Yeah, probably.
But
yeah.
Like I would, from the French Cooking one, like I would never describe that book as dated. I would describe it as classic. And
yeah,
certainly
totally.
her recipes are much more nuanced than the ones that we were talking about in say in Best of Bridge.
Yeah.
Like her
100%.
Things like Boeuf Bourguignon, she would have details like about, you know, patting the meat dry before you sear it, not crowding the pan before you sear it and all that. So
she was an amazing cook. And I think she was very serious about cooking education. And, you know, I think she was coming at it from like a very loving and passionate, but also like analytical and serious minded, like, direction. And, you know, she did, you know, she clearly took it seriously. I mean, she went to France and became a chef, you know. Yeah, Julia.
One of the greats. But what else do you want to talk about?
Well, we have a topic. And that topic is Desert Island Cookbooks. See, I didn't even beat around the bush that time, Alan.
Before I reveal a topic, I just want to... No, I'm just
kidding. Alan, should I reveal the topic or should you reveal the topic? Dumb podcaster tricks. That's
exactly.
I got those out of this book that I have back here called Podcasting for Dummies.
The topic, we've not really decided what... All we did was say, yeah, it's going to be called Desert Island Cookbooks.
Right. So I mean, mostly. And then we also... Well, I gave you a list of the ones that I was going to pick.
Yeah.
So that we wouldn't have overlap, I guess. But aside from that, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
We haven't like set up a structure for it. So did you have a structure in mind at all or?
Nope. We can go back and forth. We each have three, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I took the challenge very literally, as I am prone to doing.
I'm shocked.
And I really did pick if I could only consult three more resources, food and cooking wise, for the rest of my life, I'm pretty sure these would be the three most useful to me.
And if you were trapped on a desert island, right?
If I were trapped
understand the concept.
If I were trapped on a desert island,
like, I mostly like, my list is mostly like tiki
smugglers books. Cove, I was gonna say. Yeah.
Just kidding. That would be funny though. I did think about that a couple times. I was like, if I was actually trapped on a desert island, like, what book would I really want to have on the island with me? But I mean, I don't think that there's a cookbook that is good for that. I don't know. Listener, write in and let me know if you know like the best actual desert island cookbook. I'm curious to find out.
Like, it needs to be about bushcraft then or something, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like, exactly. And like
how to make a fire. Yeah. Yeah.
And how to shuck an oyster and that kind of stuff.
I'm sure that book exists.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yeah. Oh, if it doesn't, we should write it.
If it doesn't, someone who knows about that kind of thing should write it. Yeah.
Yeah. If I ever get stranded on a desert island, now I have a project. First, I'll have to figure out how to make a pencil and paper. Well, once I do that, right.
You could write a book on that too.
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, that's sort of, I kind of tried to take it pretty literally like that too. Like, I don't know. I guess we'll see once we get into it, like how your rationale compares to mine. But okay. I'm curious to see how it goes. Do you want to start off? Do you have any kind of like an order, like your number one, two, and three?
No, or not really. No.
They're all okay. I think I sort of have an order, but anyways, doesn't really matter. Do you want to lead off?
Sure. Don't get mad at me, Shale.
Okay.
It was actually interesting to think of it that way, like in the strict, like, what will be the most useful to you if you can only consult that for the rest of your life. And there was a lot of books that like have had a very big impact on me and I've learned a lot from, but in a way they kind of like, they've already given me whatever gifts they had to give me and I don't need to necessarily consult them every day.
Consult them any longer.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, we've talked about this 100 times, but Ratio by Michael Rollman, like, is such a powerful and effective book that I feel like I would not need it on the desert island anymore because I know most of the ratios, or at least the ones that I use frequently. Or even like the French Laundry cookbook, which is in my top 5 or 10 cookbooks of all time. Mm-hmm. I feel like the lessons I learned from it, I've taken with me and I don't often go back to that book to look at recipes. Sometimes I do. But it's more like the writing in that book on like you know, the importance of staff meal and classic techniques like braising and big pot blanching and all that. So that one didn't make the cut for the stipulations of this conversation. So,
okay. So far I'm not angry, Alan.
Well, I don't want you to be angry because I have to have on food and cooking on my list with you.
Alan, and I'm furious.
I specifically asked you to share yours so that we wouldn't have overlap, but I'll qualify and say, I don't want there to be too much overlap. And
I knew that exactly this thing was going to happen, but
on food and cooking.
I was like, once I put, like you asked me what my top three were.
Yeah.
And like, on food and cooking was obviously going to be in there.
Yeah.
And I felt bad putting it in there because I knew that you would not be able to not pick it.
Right.
And then the whole time since I shared my list with you, I was like, how is he going to not have on food and cooking?
And how come he never responded?
Here we are. So I guess round one is we can just both throw a lot of love at on food and cooking and then we can just move on from there.
Yeah, so I know we've already talked about it a lot, so I didn't want to just gush about it again. Well, we can do that too, but I wanted to explain like why it, in that context of it being one of the handful of resources you have available to you, why that book in particular would be useful and how I often use it. Mm-hmm. So like there's two main ways that I use it. One is when I'm say working with a new ingredient or an ingredient at least that I'm not particularly familiar with. Mm-hmm. On food and cooking is great as a kind of like broad survey. Like you can be working with a new veg, you're working with jicama, you're working with some vegetable that you're not, that you haven't used daily for your entire life. And you can just go read like an encyclopedic, a brief but encyclopedic kind of entry on jicama and get a broad sense of its nature, and some very like classic and common ways that it's prepared across the world. It just like gives you such a great overview and introduction to unfamiliar things.
Yeah.
So that's why I find it very, like why I would want it on the shelf at the ready for the rest of my life. But the other thing is that in terms of techniques and procedures, it starts to give you an idea of what the real like, the real factors for success for a technique are, and therefore what kind of wiggle room you have and what kind of new things you can try, because you understand the actual mechanics, like what is making that color, what is making that aroma or whatever. And once you know those central factors, you understand how you can manipulate. And so that's why it's so powerful. It's not just a reference book. It's like a real resource and aid to cooking. So that's why I need to have it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's pretty much the same story for me. It's like one of the common things that I wind up doing in my, I mean, not so much in my home cooking life, but definitely in my work life. Mm-hmm. And to some extent in my home cooking life is like, you know, like I have an ingredient or a technique that I don't have a ton of practical experience with, but that, you know, maybe I want to put on a menu or I want to find a new use for or something like that. Mm-hmm. And even like before consulting the internet in a lot of cases, like it's my first, you know, like it's my go-to resource because I know that the information in there is like
sound,
thoughtful, and for the most part, as accurate as it can be. And then, I can do a ton of research about certain things and do as many deep dives as I want after the fact. But it's like a really good sort of like having read what On Food and Cooking has to say about something sort of gives me a bit of a baseline kind of. Yeah, like a baseline of knowledge that allows me to, in some cases, like reject takes that I find everywhere on the internet or, you know, like think like it gives me a good way to sort of like sort through BS that I find, you know.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't know. It's kind of indispensable. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, like the rest of my picks are like definitely like heart based.
Right. I see. Yeah.
but On Food and Cooking is like a 100% practical. I need to have this book. If I can't have it, I don't know what.
In
most cases, I guess if I was really on a desert island and I didn't have access to the internet, it would definitely in that case be like the most important book that I had, because like it actually has real information in it, you know, not just necessarily recipes and then like some philosophical sort of like writings about how certain restaurants feel about types of food, you know, which is, you know, a lot of the content of most modern cookbooks. It's like recipes. And then also, why did we make these recipes so good? Let me tell you why.
And really wide margins and really big pictures.
Totally. I mean, for me, for foodies, cookbooks these days make great coffee table books. I honestly don't use them for much aside from that most often these days, though. Like for me, most of my cookbooks are kind of like coffee table books.
Like you flip through them to look at the awesome pictures and read a quote here and there.
Or flip through to like get inspired about something or whatever. But I don't often, not in the way that I did like early in my career, like go through like a whole book or a whole section in a book and just like look at every recipe and like try, you know, pull out like five recipes and try them all and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, I don't do that kind of thing that much anymore. So I don't know, maybe there's a book out there that I don't know about where I would just be like, oh, this is changing my life. But most of the books that changed my life like earlier on in my career, I would say.
So you've stagnated. Just kidding.
Ouch. Not at all, Alan. I'm just in my own encyclopedic resource now.
Do we go? I can stay here all day, but should we go to the next one? Or
I don't know. Is there anything like, I don't know, do you have any hot takes, fresh takes about On Food and Cooking?
No, I don't think so. We've devoted loads of time to it in the Cooking Myths episode. McGee as one of our champions of science and reasoning.
Totally. I feel a little bit now, like actually, you know, when I sent you my list and when I was having like, you know, those feelings about whether it was going to become a problem where we both needed to have On Food and Cooking in our list, I feel like maybe we should have just relegated it from the draft.
Yeah.
Although it's technically not a draft because we were both allowed to draft On Food and Cooking. So I guess whatever. Mm-hmm. We both have it on our team. Yeah. But I think maybe for future topics that are like this, where we're like, you know, choosing things and there's obvious ones, we should just like relegate them and just talk about them out the gate and then be like, okay, now here's my list. But
yeah, it's just it's like how with the top 50 restaurant list now, if you win number one, you can no longer be on the list ever again. You're just on a separate list called Best of the Best. Did you know that?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they changed it a few years ago now.
I mean, it kind of makes sense because it's just, you know, like, because like, yeah, lots of restaurants would win it for like, you know, three consecutive years. And that kind of like clogs up the top 10 a little bit, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And it makes it difficult, I think, for like new amazing restaurants to creep in there and, you know.
Their thinking behind doing that is because they're often accused, rightfully so, of like having a fairly narrow focus on, I guess, European tradition and stuff like that. But it helps open things up a bit.
Totally.
On Food and Cooking should just be relegated to such a list for us. And
the best of the best.
It's interesting. So you said that the rest, your next two picks are kind of from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
My second pick is not from the heart at all. It's sheer, like, total analytical, cerebral. I don't even particularly like the book, but I just feel like I...
Wow.
Can I tell you what it is? Or?
Yeah, so definitely. After that preamble, I don't think that I could wait for a whole topic section to hear.
My second book is Advanced Bread and Pastry by Michel Suat.
Oh.
This is a text. This is like a tome. Like it's one of the core texts that you would, for instance, at NAIT, like if you take the baking and pastry arts program, like this is one of the most important books that you will own. Mm-hmm. And I included it because I feel like I've only kind of dipped my toes into that world, like through culinary school and what little exposure I had to it in industry. Mm-hmm. And so but it's an essential part of food and cooking for me. And so like I need it because I don't actually understand.
It's an area of cooking that maybe you don't have your base knowledge is maybe a little less fleshed out than mm-hmm. other areas. And so it's very valuable to you in that, you know, if you need to work on dessert ideas or dessert related techniques and mm-hmm. things like that, then you have a resource to be able to.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, like I need the formulas in that book and I need to review the procedures oftentimes before I do stuff like that. So that, and I do feel like, not right now, but at some point in my career, like I want to and need to do a much deeper dive on that whole world. And so that book would be with me to do that.
Cool. I don't think I own that book. Sorry, what's it called again?
Advanced Bread and Pastry. It has a Advanced Bread and Pastry. The subtitle is A Professional Approach. And yeah,
sounds like a textbook.
The author is Michelle Suwa, who I think founded the San Francisco Bread Institute or something. Like he's a big time San Francisco baker. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good pick. Do you have any examples of things that you've used out of the book?
Yeah. Like and this does not happen very often, which is why I need the resource, but like if I ever need to make a laminated dough, I'm rereading the section on viennoiserie, for instance.
Right.
And yeah, for breads, like I have a handful of like quick breads and simple pan breads and stuff that I can make without very much thought at home. But if I want to do anything involving like a starter, a poolish, a biga, like
you're checking the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I sort of have a book like that, not so much for bread, mm-hmm. But for desserts. Mm-hmm. But I don't use it very often anymore. And I don't think I have it in the room here with me. So embarrassingly, I don't know the author's name, but it's called In the Sweet Kitchen.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it's a pretty thick tome. It's not maybe as big as most like textbooks, but mm-hmm. it is very comprehensive.
Mm-hmm, cool.
And has like a lot of, you know, techniques that were, you know, fairly modern like 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's not associated with a restaurant or?
No, it's not. So it also has a subtitle. It's called In the Sweet Kitchen, The Definitive Baker's Companion.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And it's by Regan Daly. And I don't really know too much about Regan Daly. And in fact, I don't even really remember where I got the book from.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, like, I think I probably purchased it from like, from a cookbook store in Vancouver and asked for a recommendation for like a pastry book. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's what got recommended or something like that.
Cool.
And I think I just flipped through it and picked it up. But yeah, I have used several techniques out of it. I don't know if I've like taken recipes like whole cloth from it, but yeah, I often consult it for techniques.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Anyways, it's not really fair of me to bring it up because it's not in my list. So
what is on your list?
Okay. Well, On Food and Cooking is on my list. My next pick is a cookbook that's called The Morrow Cookbook. Mm-hmm. It is associated with a restaurant called Morrow, which I believe is in London.
Okay.
And it's like, I don't know, I guess, and I've never eaten there. And honestly, I don't really remember how I kind of got turned on to it, the idea of it. Maybe potentially I like picked it up one day in a bookstore and was flipping through it and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, the food in here looks amazing. Mm-hmm. Or potentially I heard something about the restaurant and then, you know, went and sought out the cookbook. And, but I think my parents gave it to me for Christmas, like one Christmas early on in my career. It was one of like the first sort of like modernish kind of like restaurant based cookbooks that I had. Mm-hmm. And what I was really into about it was that like I had a fair amount of exposure to like, you know, French and European continental sort of like techniques and cuisine and, mm-hmm. you know, North American stuff, obviously. And, you know, a fair amount of exposure to like Italian food through like the Food Network and through, you know, eating out in America and that kind of thing. And sort of, you know, it sort of permeates the food culture or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like Spanish food as, you know, like, I guess like when people think of when North American people, and I consider myself, you know, like, and Shale at the time that he received this cookbook was within this, like, you know, group of people that, like, really all most people know about Spanish food is that they're tapas. Mm-hmm. And all most people really know about tapas is that it's a bunch of appetizers or something like that, you know? And so, you know, like, I guess it sort of opened my eyes a little bit, because there is this, like, there is this whole other world of, like, you know, Spanish food that is, like, you know, very different. Mm-hmm. But then also there's a certain subculture of like Mediterranean and like North African food culture that was brought to Spain by the Moors. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that sort of like sub or like undercurrent of Spanish food is what inspired the authors of this cookbook to open their restaurant in London. Mm-hmm. And the authors are Sam and Sam Clark, husband and wife, potentially. I can't exactly remember. That seems to ring a bell, though. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I just, you know, like, it kind of was a bit of a revelation for me.
Yeah.
Flipping through it and seeing all of this food that a lot of it I had never really, you know, heard of before. And then, you know, it's a beautiful book, you know, with beautiful photographs, and the recipes are really great. Yeah, in fact, potentially, like, I didn't even know about it until my parents gifted it to me. I don't exactly remember how that went. Yeah. But yeah, like, I really, when I got it, I did this like crazy deep dive into it, like kind of like what I was talking about before, where mm-hmm. I basically read the whole thing like front to back, and, you know, like read every word on every page and was just like captivated by the recipes. And there was so much stuff in there that was just like, oh my God, I'll bet that's amazing. I have to try to make that. Mm-hmm. I think the first sort of recipe in the book is the bread that they make for their restaurant. Mm-hmm. And there's just like this very specific procedure that they use. And it's like, you know, a sourdough technique, and they make their own sourdough from scratch in it. And they teach you how to do that. And then the bread is like, you know, a big, like, really high hydration loaf that just kind of like, you know, expands like horizontally when you bake it, and you just get this big round, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, like, that was captivating. And I don't think I talked about it too much in the episode where we talked about like stolen food ideas.
Right. Yeah.
But probably if I had to, you know, like, now that I'm thinking about it in retrospect, I probably stole more dishes from this cookbook that went on to menus of restaurants that I worked at, or as specials in places. I probably stole more from this cookbook than from any other cookbook I've ever had. Mm-hmm. And the stuff in it is like really replicable and really amazing.
Cool. What's an example of like a preparation recipe or a dish from the book that's kind of stayed with you even till now?
Okay. So a lot of stuff from it, I don't cook so much now, but probably like, so got some kind of like hazy recollections about this, but, you know, like one of the things that's in the book, that's like one of my favorite things, and that I definitely learned my initial technique for making it out of this book. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've ever used it on a menu anywhere, but I've definitely used it on several like special menus that I've made. Mm-hmm. Is a Spanish tortilla, mm-hmm. which, you know, like, is basically like a potato frittata or something. Yeah. At its very base level.
Mm-hmm.
but it's an amazingly beautiful, delicate potato frittata. And if you make it right, oh my, that's some of the best food you can have. But yeah, like, definitely, I think my first exposure to the idea that that even existed was from this book. Yep. And I was like, how is this a tortilla?
Yeah.
This is not a tortilla. You know, like that was when Shail got this book, that was Shail. Like, yep. That's not a tortilla. That's an omelet. So yeah. You know, that is definitely something that is still with me that I think probably my first exposure to was from that book. And then like probably, you know, at more than one place that I worked at, I pushed to put, there's like a chocolate tart recipe that's in this book. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many people that I worked with know that I stole it from this book, but like, yeah, on several dessert menus I had, and definitely a couple times I called it on the menu, the Moro chocolate tart, but it's basically like a chocolate flan sitting on top of like a layer of apricot jam.
Okay.
And yeah. With like a, basically the crust is like a pâte brisée, you know, it's very simple. But man, it's so delicious, so rich, and like so intense in flavor. Like,
cool.
Yeah, it's great. And like another one that I've used several times out of there, and that I actually haven't really seen anywhere else, and I'm sure it exists in Spain. Like, I'm sure it's probably common, but is ajo blanco, which is like a cold soup,
something white.
Yeah, yeah. I think ajo means garlic. Yeah.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
I think so. So the name of it is white garlic, but the soup, it's a cold soup. So it's, and like some people call it white gazpacho.
Right. Yeah.
But basically the base of it is, like almond cream. Mm-hmm. So you soak almonds and then you blend them until they're completely smooth and then flavor it with roasted garlic and olive oil. And it's basically, those are the, you know, three sort of like big main ingredients. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah.
I've heard that actually, like, I don't know if it would have been in culinary school or what, that like the primordial gazpacho had no tomatoes, which kind of makes sense because tomatoes wouldn't have been in Spain until after they came to the New World. But like, yeah, that it was primarily bread and almonds and garlic. Yeah. Don't know if that's true, but someone definitely told me that.
It probably actually says that in this book. My memory is just horrible. but yeah, it definitely like, it inspired me a lot early in my career and I value it a lot. And I go back to it every now and then when I'm like, you know, feeling like I need a little inspiration you know, or when I'm planning stuff that's like, you know, a little bit on the Spanish side and I'm trying to, you know, come up with ideas for, there's a bunch of tapas in it. There's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just so you know, Shail, the North Africans that occupied Spain until the 15th century, they were the Moops.
Oh, really?
Not the Moors. Yeah, the Moops.
Oh, that's interesting.
Do you know what I'm talking about or no?
No, I haven't the faintest idea.
You're not a Seinfeld guy?
Oh, God. This is a joke?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. No, I mean, like I am, I appreciate it's Seinfeld, like
one
but
of the
I
most
haven't
famous
watched
Seinfeld
since...
jokes of all time. I can't believe you didn't get that. Oh,
sorry. Alan.
Okay. Cut it out.
And now I probably have to cut it out because it's going to be so awkward. And I'm so tempted to ask you to explain the joke to me now, but like,
I mean,
just going down like the most awkward possible, like conversational thread right now, and it's just,
do you want me to explain it to you after we're done recording?
No, just explain it to me now.
George Costanza is playing Trivial Pursuit with someone. There's a lot more going on, but I'll cut to the chase. And George asks his opponent, the trivia question is, what group occupied Spain until the end of the 15th century? And his opponent says, well, that's easy, the Moors. But there was a misprint on the Trivial Pursuit card, and it said Moops.
And of course, George is not going to believe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He says, oh, no, I'm sorry. It's the Moops, the Moops. And it's funny because I think it was, well, sorry, it's especially funny because I think it was inspired by, there was a, I don't know if it's true, but there was at least an urban legend that they used to intentionally put misprints into Trivial Pursuit cards to be able to catch forgeries and counterfeit like black market versions of it.
Really?
Yeah. Anyways.
Although not really fair if it's in the answer.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if that's based off a real life story that happened to Larry David.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me.
Me neither.
Okay, Moro.
Okay, Moro.
Sounds,
yeah.
I'm gonna look into that restaurant. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah. And I don't know why I didn't make more of an effort to go eat there when I was in London. Mm-hmm. Like, looking back at it, that was probably
what were you thinking?
But I don't know. And actually, I don't even know if it's open anymore.
Oh, is that right? They must be open. They have a cookbook.
Yeah, they're going to be open forever. Yeah, man, it's open.
Oh, good.
Shale's just an idiot that didn't go there.
So it's not too late.
No, that's true.
Not like Peter's steak and pizza.
Yeah, it's pretty sad about Peter's. Peter's is a lot closer, though.
That's true, yeah.
So yeah, Moro cookbook.
Cool.
Yeah, one of my desert island picks. And I think like the reason why like I don't have more practical picks is because I kind of feel like you do. Like I sort of feel like in most circumstances and like probably I would say desserts maybe a little less so than my, you know, savory technique repertoire, but like I kind of feel like I have a pretty good repertoire in terms of my own base knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so like it's more for me, my picks are more about like, you know, what, you know, like what would I not, I don't know, like on a, like what has the most sentimental value to me as a cook and like connects me with my passion mm-hmm. the most readily or something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. I don't know. That's more like what my picks were about.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
So Alan, you have one more pick? Yeah.
Yeah.
This is your number three.
Yeah. And I don't even know if you'll let me do it, but my number three resource. Oh, sorry. Was it supposed to be a book? Oh, I thought it was just a resource.
If you say the internet, this podcast is over.
It's on the internet, but Shale, my blog Button Soup. If I knew I could only have three books, I would print out everything on Button Soup and put it in a binder.
That's a really good answer, actually. Because I will allow this.
So it exists electronically, so it's okay if you want to disqualify it. But like it is my family cookbook now. And right. So there are loads of recipes that, especially ones that I don't make daily or weekly because they're like seasonal things that we make at home, and things that like I well be, just because of my nature like I want accurate recipes to the gram and stuff mm-hmm. That have me going on to the site just to retrieve the recipe so I can make it for my family. And it's especially things like charcuterie, like we get a pig in the fall and we do sausage and ham, and that's something like I know exactly the recipes I want to use, and I've like tailored them to my preferences over the years. Or like certain pie, like pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving, like I've got a pumpkin pie filling recipe that I make from scratch, and you know mm-hmm. Christmas cakes and stuff like that. So I do actually want to have some kind of physical printed and bound version of it that might become like a Sotheby family cookbook or something.
Totally.
But in terms of like when I think about yeah, like a set of recipes and food information that I would be that it would be disastrous to me to lose it. that's one of them. It's and yeah, certainly in the top three. So if you'll allow, Button Soup.
I mean, it's a little skewed away from the topic, I feel like.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with your pick. Like, yeah. Right, desert island picks are like, what could I not live without?
Right, that's right? Yeah, exactly, yeah. And like, if it had been a printed bound family cookbook that I got from my aunt or grandma or something, you would allow that, right?
Oh yeah,
yeah,
100%.
Same thing, exactly the same thing.
Totally, exactly the same thing. Since right now I can hear your printer going in the background, exactly. And you're printing off everything. Alan, how often do you update those recipes? Does your pumpkin pie recipe now say that you're supposed to brulee the top of it or what?
No, it doesn't right now, but that is exactly the kind of thing that I go back and add. And so you can, I don't know, right. Sometimes I'll like put it in as an editor's note and put a date, but usually because it's just a personal resource and I'm not a journalist, I just go back and
you just go in and update
make an
it.
Update. Especially fun stuff like that, where it's like at the end of the post, you just be like, oh, and fun side note, you can, you know, yeah, torch the top of your pumpkin pie and make it crispy and delicious. And
yeah.
So you can look forward to some kind of addition like that on the pumpkin pie recipe.
Okay, can't wait. When I'm pouring, is there a way to like filter the posts to ones that have like editor's notes?
No, not presently. That'd be a lot of work to put in at this point.
I'm sure there's a plug-in for it. Okay, Button Soup. It's a great cookbook. Everybody should check it out.
The photos suck, but...
Oh, they're not that bad, Alan. Oh, they're pretty good. I mean, you know, for like a kitchen blog, I don't know, man. Like, I guess a lot of the blogs that are out there now, it's like all about having a couple nice pictures and then just like...
stealing a recipe
no
from
actual recipe.
Yeah.
Alan, your blog is a diamond in the rough.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I guess we're on my last pick then.
Yeah.
My last pick is like you said, the French Laundry cookbook. I basically internalized it.
Mm-hmm.
And this book also I have pretty much internalized,
mm-hmm.
but kind of like not really to the extent that like I don't have to go back and check on things from time to time.
Right.
And especially because like the style of food isn't something that I'm cooking all that often. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my last desert island pick is the Bouchon cookbook.
Okay.
Which is another of Keller's restaurants. And well, in fact, there are a bunch of them,
mm-hmm.
right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, like, unlike the French Laundry cookbook, it's much more useful. I don't know. I mean, the French Laundry cookbook has a lot of amazing techniques in it,
mm-hmm.
and you can certainly apply a lot of the knowledge that's in the French. And there is a lot of like you said, there are a lot of fundamentals in the French Laundry cookbook. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like they just, you know, hand over recipes and say good luck.
Right.
Like, yep. you know, there is, yep. you know, there's a big section on big pot blanching, which we talk about all the time. And, you know.
Yes.
So there is definitely a lot of like useful reference information in the French Laundry cookbook. But like you said, I've internalized a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bouchon cookbook for me is much more like a style of food. I think that like, I mean, the French Laundry cookbook would be great if my dream for the rest of my life was to run a fine dining restaurant.
Right.
But that's not really what I'm up to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really what I'm after.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the food that's in there. Like, it's amazing and beautiful and imaginative. But to me, Bouchon, I think, is like more along the lines of, you know, what I would want to eat.
Right.
You know, and what I would want to serve to my friends and family and things like that. And obviously it's not comprehensive. Most of it, it's like, you know, it's pretty like European continental,
mm-hmm.
You know, like it's very like it's a brasserie,
right? Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like pretty French and pretty pretty like French bistro style,
right,
food.
Yeah. Can you remind, if I remember right, like a Bouchon is a type of restaurant in Lyon that's like a bistro, I think. Is that...
Oh, really? Actually, I don't necessarily know that, but...
But yeah, I mean, certainly sounds... more the, yeah, like your French onion soup and roasts and braises.
To me, a Bouchon is just like a mouthful.
Oh.
Like, I think that's what the French word means, but
really?
I'm going to do a little research here, Alan.
A Bouchon is a type of restaurant found in Lyon, France, that serves traditional Lyonnaise cuisine, such as sausages, salad Lyonnaise, duck pate, or roasts.
Oh, where did you find that? In the Bouchon cookbook?
On the Wikipedia entry for Bouchon.
Oh, Wikipedia. Oh, it's a cork, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Not a mouthful at all. It's a cork. Yeah. I knew it was a something. French vocabulary is freaking horrible. I should be fired.
I have from what?
From life. Oh. From the podcast, from any situation where I'm supposed to be a knowledge resource for people around food.
The Bouchon cookbook, I do not own. I have flipped through it. I've not eaten at any of the Bouchon locations, but yeah, some of the rest, like it's the much more rustic and casual French food. Like we said, like French onion soup and pâtés and terrines and
breads. And there is like amazing desserts in it too, which are like more on the rustic side, which, you know, tend to be the types of desserts that I usually wind up preferring. Like there's a really amazing tarte tatin recipe in it. Like there's, I don't know. It's like pretty comprehensive when it comes to French bistro food. Mm-hmm. And which it's just like, you know, it's full of comfort food. It's not all just like heavy food either. There's like, you know, beautiful salads in there like, you know, it's just full of really inspiring rustic food ideas. Mm-hmm. And yeah, for me, like it's closer to what I would want to, like I said before, it's closer to what I would want to eat. It's closer to what I would want to serve. Mm-hmm. And the copy that I have here is literally destroyed. And I have another copy that's like kind of in pristine condition, but I never open it. And I just use this old smashed up destroyed version that's been like in several kitchens that I worked in. And like, it's just like the binding is coming apart and the hardcover is coming away from like the, from the pages, and all of the page sections are like, it's in rough shape, this thing. But I've used it tons. And not so much. I have used it. I used it in a couple of restaurants that I worked in, to help design recipes for like feature items and stuff. Mm-hmm. I haven't ripped a ton of recipes from it and put them on restaurant menus just because, like, I don't know, they're almost a little too, like, I don't know, most of the places I think that I've worked in, they wouldn't necessarily be suitable.
I see, yeah.
Because they, you know, either aren't quite fancy enough, or they're just like, you know, like they're too French,
right,
potentially,
yeah,
or something. But
escargot.
Totally. There's a great escargot treatment in there.
Yeah.
And actually, I think when I worked at the Blue Pear, I think I designed, I don't know, we definitely did an escargot dish that Darcy designed the technique for, but I think I pulled an escargot dish out of their, technique for it out of there. Yeah.
I was thinking about escargot this week, or I saw, you know, that La Petite Itza, you must, because Sean's there.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot what it was called for a second.
Yeah, so on top of Eleanor and Laurent in Garneau. And I haven't eaten there yet. I'm really excited to. But I saw that they were serving escargot because they're all about the like French bistro classics.
Totally.
And it just got me thinking, like, where I've never worked with snails. Like, I've never worked in a kitchen where we brought them in. And it got me thinking about, first of all, where do they where do they source them? And also, like, this is a bad business idea, but like, can you raise them in Edmonton? And like, could you, who would, I don't like, are they still on? Like my only exposure to them was my dad used to get them. If we were at like a steakhouse in the 90s and they had escargot on the menu, he would get it. I don't know. Is it still like, it's not on the menu at the Keg, is it?
Great question. I don't think so. I don't know though. It might be. That would be hilarious if it was actually.
But anyways, it seems like a perfect backyard.
Except I don't think in Edmonton. I mean, in the summer, probably, for sure.
Yeah.
But 100% not in the winter. Right, okay, so in our childhood tasting menus, I talked about one of my courses was like a single raw shrimp, I think, or a single, And because this, when I was a kid, we used to go to this island with some friends of ours, and there was a shrimp fisherman, and he gave us shrimp like live off, like directly out of the trap one day when he was like coming in. I don't know if it was, I don't think it was the same guy, but there was somebody on that island also who was raising snails.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if it was just for personal use or if he was selling them to restaurants, but yeah, somebody had like a little snail operation going.
I mean, I'm sure you can
remember too.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah. Like, and I know like anyone who's lived in BC knows that slugs love it there.
Yeah.
Everything that you do gets attacked by slugs all the time. If you try to grow a garden, there's like slugs all over it. And so, yeah, I think like, you know, if we were in BC, like raising snails would probably be a great idea.
Like, I don't think it needs to be out. Like, I'm surely there's like a terrarium kind of setup you could do.
Yeah, I'm sure you could do it indoors too.
Okay.
It just seems a little less cool. It seems a little sad. Maybe like in a greenhouse or something. Maybe
Oh, yeah, totally.
But probably not in a greenhouse over winter. So I don't know.
I'm remembering vaguely. I think that there was an episode of The F Word. Did you ever watch that show?
Yeah.
It was a Gordon Ramsay show.
Right.
Where he raises his own snails.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Cool. Does he, how does it go?
I can't. I told you everything don't I remember. Remember about it.
I like all I like kind of know or have seen about raising snails is that like, you know, they need to be in like, they need to have, needs to be like a pretty moist environment, I think. And then they need to have like, obviously some like food source, which I think is like usually like leafy green vegetables or just vegetables in general or whatever.
Right.
But like, you have to have them enclosed in a way that they like, I don't think cages really work. They have to kind of be walled in, and they go everywhere. Like they're on the ceiling, they're on the walls. They're like, they just like, they just wander around, and they can go wherever they want. They can just like hang off the ceiling. So it's really weird. They're always just like all over the walls and the ceiling and everything. They're just like climbing around doing their thing. They're funny. It seems like they're not moving, but like you can leave them all in the bottom of a bathtub, and like you'll come back like 10 minutes later and they're like all awful. Like they've all crawled out of the bathtub.
This is something that happened to you?
Yeah, something. I don't know. I have some weird memory about. Anyways, I've never actually gotten live snails. The only snails that I've ever cooked are canned, which is like, I know, super sad.
Right.
And bad and dumb, but whatever. I still liked them. I loved them when I was a kid. We used to have it fairly often, actually. Like, my dad used to get snails in a can, I think, and cook them in garlic butter, and we would have it as like a fancy fancy thing. I don't know if it was just because I thought it was weird and fun to eat snails or something, but but yeah, we used to do that sometimes.
Was there anything else about Bouchon that you wanted to share?
Well, yeah, like sort of also like one of the things, well, we also, when I was young, my dad used to make French onion soup.
Oh, really?
Like as a special thing.
Yeah.
And so I was like, in my early cooking career, I was like pretty obsessed with like, you know, like finding a perfect version of French onion soup or perfecting my French onion soup technique as like, you know, it was just like one of those things where I was like, this is an amazing dish. And if it's done well, it's like, you know, transcendent, but you know, like you have to, you know, you have to do it well to make it really be amazing. And so, yeah, I just, and like I made the version out of Bouchon, like, I don't know, probably 50 times or something, just like for different things, like for myself or for, you know, entertaining or, yeah, I've made it a lot. And it's a pretty long, like as you would expect from like Keller, like everything is like, everything is taking it slow and everything is the long way. And and you get a really amazing result, you know. So that's like sort of one of the things that's like close to my heart from it is just like the French onion soups that I've had out of it. I just like, I haven't made it in a while though. And yeah, like the desserts are a big part of it for me too. Like, you know, all of the rustic desserts that are in there, like it's a really great reference for me for that. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you about, okay, this is a French onion soup trick that Lisa taught me. You tell me if you've heard of it or if you think that,
sure.
I don't know if it's in the Bouchon recipe already or what, but Lisa found that one of the main issues with the French onion soup was that by the time you ate it, the bread was totally soggy and you didn't have any of the like nice crunch of the toasted bread.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would melt cheese over the bread on top of the bread and then invert the bread on top of the soup. So there's like a cheese layer between the soup and the bread, right. And then put
to
more
protect the bread.
Yeah, exactly. And then put more cheese on top and gratin that. Have you ever heard of that?
That's a cool idea. I haven't actually ever heard of that. But it seems like a smart thing to do if you want to keep your bread nice and crispy. I think it's okay to have some of the bread be, I don't know, soggy is not the right word, but like, saturated. You know, some of the bread, saturated.
Yeah,
exactly. So like, to me, it's kind of like, okay, there, it, like definitely always, and I'm pretty sure it says this in the Bouchon version, but like you put cheese on top of the soup and then you put the bread and then you put more cheese on top of the bread and then you gratin it.
Okay.
So there is a little bit of cheese in there, but you're not actually like gratining the cheese on the mm-hmm. bread and then flipping it over and putting it in.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, I'm sure that that would give the bread a little extra protection. Mm-hmm. And if it still wound up soaking up a bunch of the soup, I could see that being like a really good technique.
Yeah.
She just make that up. Maybe she should write a cookbook.
I don't know if she discovered it on her own or if her high school foods teacher told her. I don't know.
Huh, cool. But yeah, like I think as long as you keep the top piece, like the top part of the bread nice and crispy and you get it really nice and crispy. And I think the Bouchon version has like whole slices of a few different kinds of cheese. I think it has Comté and Emmental. Mm-hmm. Should I look in the book right now?
No.
Too late. If I can put this book up on the table. It's not going to be called French onion soup, is it?
Soup à l'oignon.
Oh my God, I forgot there's a lentil soup in here.
Lentil soup?
I love lentil soup. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, it calls for slices of Comté and Emmentaler.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sure some of the slices go underneath and then some of the slices go on top.
Okay.
Which is nice because then you get like these slices of cheese with like, you know, straight edges. So the edges wind up getting like really crispy and the edges of the bread. And they don't also like, if you use grated cheese, you have a tendency to like cover the entirety of the piece of bread. Mm-hmm. But when you're using slices, like, you know, some of the bread is usually sticking out outside of where the slices right. go. And so you get, you know, the bread is toasting and the cheese is getting toasted and mm-hmm. bubbly and
mm-hmm. cool.
Works out great.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing from the Bouchon cookbook that was like, actually like a huge part of my repertoire for a long time was quiche. The quiche that's in there is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. It's like a real French bistro quiche. It's like high.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like 3 inches high or whatever with like, you know, like a tall straight sided crust.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like,
I can picture it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And the recipe that's in there works really well, although you kind of need the right tools, which are kind of hard to get. You basically need a ring mold. Or you can kind of use a spring form.
Yeah.
Although spring form doesn't quite work as well. The bottom tends to not cook as well as it should and stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, you can use a spring form, which is probably like the easiest thing to do and the thing that's like the least prone to potential failure. Mm-hmm. But like the way that it is in the book, it's like, I think a 9-inch round, like 4-inch high ring mold, and you just drape the pastry inside the ring mold.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it has a tendency to like, if you don't do it quite the right way, and if you have like, you know, if your pastry has like slightly too large chunks of butter in it or something, and then it gets holes in the bottom, then you can wind up with leaks.
Yes.
In it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be pretty careful.
Mm.
But yeah, amazing. And I haven't made one of those in forever. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm really craving one, Alan. Mm. Am I going to make a quiche this weekend?
Tonight? Oh.
If I started it tonight,
yeah,
it would be done by like tomorrow morning.
They did quiche kind of in that style at District for a while, right?
I don't know
if you were there.
I think so, yeah. But quiche in the real style.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. in love with quiche, and I wouldn't have to give that up because I would have the book with me on the island.
Right. Yep.
I'd just have to find some turtle eggs and just kidding. There's birds on the island. Pelican eggs.
Sandpiper eggs.
Yeah. Sandpiper eggs. Exactly. Probably seagull eggs is what you'd wind up with.
Maybe another business idea, but one interesting thing that I see on old menu, like old, like from Escoffia era, but even in some old menus from Edmonton, so like circa circa 1912 or so, they have plover eggs.
Oh.
And I, when I read that, it again blew my mind. So I was like, well, where did they get plover eggs from? I don't know. Do plovers?
I actually have no idea what a plover is, Alan. Do you, can you tell me what a plover is?
Okay. I should look this up, but in my mind, like a killdeer is a kind of plover. Do you know what a killdeer is?
I also don't know what a killdeer is. I guess I'm not a birder. Is that, or is that a kind of dog? What? Bird watcher. That's
a birder.
I think a birder is a kind of dog that chases birds, and a bird watcher is a human who watches out for birds.
Well, anyways, plovers are, I was reminded of them because of sandpipers. Like they're like a coast, like a shore bird.
Okay.
And their eggs were delicacies. But when I read that they served plover eggs in Edmonton in 1912, I was like, were they chasing birds around the shorelines in Edmonton or were they like shipped in on blocks of ice from down east?
Okay, well, we can do a whole episode about plover eggs one time.
Yeah. Well, you can do the episode about the plover egg farm that I'm going to start in my backyard.
Oh, yeah, totally. Talk about your hot business ideas. Like, oh, man, you know what we should do an episode about one time? Is like the kind of, you know how like there's sort of, and like in some way, like I'm totally grateful for this like culture that exists, but in some way I also find it hilarious. But there's like a lot of you know, like people who have ideas for food provision. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, a farm of some type, like, you know, we're gonna start a farm and we're gonna grow nothing but, I don't know, shaggy mane mushrooms or like, you know, and then like, I guess the intention usually is to like sell them to restaurants, mm-hmm. Or to try and like find a way to sell them to grocery stores or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like what's another good example? Oh, well, like, Haskaps is a pretty good example that's actually working out pretty well mm-hmm. in Edmonton, mm-hmm. but there are a lot and like a lot of people are being educated about what Haskaps are and, you know, mm-hmm. yeah. But like it always takes so much work to educate people about new ingredients and things like mm-hmm. that. And so like, you know, I always find it fascinating that people, you know, like get this idea in their mind that like, oh yeah, like, you know, we just got this farm and, you know, we're gonna raise nothing but plovers and right. and people love plover eggs and you can't get them anywhere else, so yeah. we're gonna have like, you know, monopoly on the plover egg market and it's gonna be great. And then like, you know, they come to your restaurant and they're like, yeah, we can sell you these plover eggs, and you're like, oh yeah, awesome, like what are those? And then they're like, oh well, the plover is a bird that reminds me of a sandpiper and it's actually a coastal bird and the eggs are delicacies and I'm sure your customers would love them. And you're like, oh wow, cool, okay, that's neat. You know, can I get a sample? And they're like, yeah, sure, I'll send you a sample. And then they give you a few plover eggs and then you're like, wow, this is cool. And then you're like, and how much do they cost? And it's like, they're about $7 or $8 an egg. Exactly. And you're like,
yeah,
or something like that. There's always some kind of gotcha yeah. where it's like, yeah, like I cannot use this product, unfortunately. Like, yeah. You know,
the price or yeah. the availability. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just the even just like educating your diners about it, you know, yeah. like can be a barrier in that way. Like, yeah. I don't know. I think it's very interesting. Do you have any like honorable mention books for your desert island list, Alan?
Charcuterie by Michael Rollman.
Oh, yeah.
Because it changed my life, but also because, yeah, the recipes are so solid and reliable, and it's such a that book covers a lot of ground. Like, it's not just ham and bacon. It's like everything from sausages, pâtés, terrines, confit, jerky, smoked salmon, like,
yeah,
all of that. So that's a really powerful book, I think. Yeah, I mean, and there's lots of books that I love to just sit down and flip through. Well, kind of like you were saying, like coffee table style.
Right.
But yeah, I can't think of anything that quite has the real, like, practical, useful, you know, information dense, beyond things like ratio, French laundry, charcuterie.
Yeah, I feel like ratio should go in your honorable mentions. Like, yeah, like you said, you wouldn't necessarily need to have it because most of it you've internalized. Mm. But like, yeah, that book.
Yeah,
I think ratio would go in my honorable mentions for sure. Mm.
La Russe Gastronomique, maybe.
Whoa, intense.
Like, I have to admit that I don't often like find the recipes very useful or contemporary.
Right.
But just like, yeah, as a reference, and it does, that book does surprise me sometimes because it on the surface is so staunchly classical. Yeah. But there's still so much to glean from that world. Like, it's not all plover eggshell. There's like really interesting, like, for instance, this summer I was completely randomly happened upon an entry on a Polish soup called chłodnik.
Okay.
Which is like a chilled beet and yogurt and sorrel soup. And I was like,
sounds amazing.
I have sorrel in my yard. I have beets from my mother-in-law. I have like dill flowers. It was just like this perfect, like, oh, I can make that right now. And it's like, it was really delicious. And I didn't know that it existed or that. And I was kind of like racking my brain for ways to use sorrel too this summer. But so yeah, it's still, there's still a lot of treasures in there.
If you ever have too much sorrel on your hands, just bag some up and call your old pal Shale. Sure. I'll come by and pick some up.
There was more than a lot of it. We got our hard frost before I even harvested a lot of it.
Picked it all.
Now in the mornings when I walk Cora to school, she picks a frozen leaf of sorrel and munches on it as we walk to school. It's so weird to me.
Really?
But yeah. Like,
I mean, that seems like it would be very refreshing.
Yeah. Frozen and acidic. Just the idea of biting into frozen like lettuce basically is kind of makes my teeth hurt. But
yeah, I don't know. I think, I wonder.
This is my homework assignment.
Like,
it?
If you could make like a very delicate salad out of like beautifully frozen, delicate greens and not have them melt before they hit the table, I wonder.
Huh.
That's like a really interesting idea. Actually, like eating frozen greens.
Yeah. And is it the commentary is like, winter is coming and our gardens we're getting our first hard frost and this is what, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like maybe, maybe it's a harvest story or something. Mm-hmm. like that I don't know. I mean, you would obviously, like, to do it properly, you would have to pick the beautiful greens in the peak of freshness and then like freeze them in a way that like they didn't lose you know, much of their, you would have to like freeze them very quickly. Mm-hmm. To make sure that they didn't just go brown and gross and mm-hmm. get sludgy and stuff. But yeah, I'll bet there's a way to do it where it would be like really delicious and refreshing and enjoyable and still feel vibrant. And
but it's always,
I'm really curious. Tell Cora that she's inspired me to try a completely different thing that I have never even thought about trying before.
Like, the dish would just be called Lazy Gardener. Like, the gardener didn't bring everything in before frost. So
maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe you could just call it early frost and maybe it's not the gardener's fault. Alan,
I like
maybe
that.
Just yeah.
That's a nice name. Okay. Actually. Yeah,
yeah. Or, I'm curious though.
Yeah, it's like damned early frost or something. Like,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But yeah, I like, maybe if you got some dry ice or something and you were able to like freeze things really quickly. Mm. And so that they maintained their texture but also were like frozen like little crispy bits, would be pretty awesome. Yeah, I guess my honorable mentions is like In the Sweet Kitchen, which I already brought up. Mm-hmm. And then Culinary Artistry. I never use it anymore, but do you know that book at all?
Is that the one by the same folks who wrote The Flavor Bible?
Oh yeah,
and
I think,
and
so
what to drink with what you eat. Yeah, I've never held that book in my hands, but I've heard Such lofty chefs as Grant Achatz say it's one of their favorite books of all time. So
yeah, like it's just, it's basically like, it's like an inspiration Bible something.
Yeah.
You know, like all it is, like basically the whole book is just like lists of ingredients and then ingredients that, you know, like in like either classically or in their estimation or for some other reason, some of it is like, some of it is like food chemistry related. Like some of it has to do with stuff that is said in On Food and Cooking and things like that. But basically like they just, it's like the book is just a dictionary of ingredients. And then it's like a thesaurus basically for ingredients.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, like you look up sorrel and then it just has like a list of things that like go well with it and things that like kind of, I think it's broken down into categories. I haven't looked at it in quite a while, but I think it's broken down into categories like, you know, some things that like counterbalance and some things that enhance the flavor and things like that.
Right. Yeah.
And like some usually gives like some savory suggestions and some sweet suggestions. Mm-hmm. And for like coming up with recipes, it, you know, like especially in my early career, it was like, you know, I used it all the time, you know, and they have so many suggestions that, you know, like there's always going to be something that could kind of fit the concept that you have you know, and you're just kind of looking at it for suggestions and then riffing on them. Yep. And it's, yeah, I don't know, super useful in that way.
Cool.
Even though the information in it is like somewhat subjective and kind of made up in a way.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's like a good sounding board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is how I use their other book, the Flavor Bible, like as just like a, you know, like I know I need, I'm working with corn and I know I want honey and lime on it. And like, what's the, it's just like any other component. Like, what are some ideas? So
totally.
Yeah, I could see the value of something like that.
Yeah. And actually, I don't think I've ever held the Flavor Bible. Maybe we should.
We can swap if you want.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.